From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Mary Poppins, the song told us, was practically perfect in every way. But that was just a story. Now, says my guest tonight, millions of moms think they have to be perfect in every way. And, she says, they're going crazy trying. Tonight on Point, over-parenting and the mommy trap, American motherhood and the impossible pursuit of perfection. But first tonight, we turn to Washington, where the Food and Drug Administration has announced the formation of an independent drug safety oversight board to track medicines after FDA approval and keep doctors and the public informed on safety issues. After recent scandals over the safety of Vioxx and COX-2 inhibitors, the FDA has been under mounting pressure. Joining me now from Washington is Gardner Harris. He covers the FDA for the New York Times. Gardner Harris, thanks for being with us tonight.
I'm glad to be here, Tom.
Been tremendous pressure on the FDA. Will this new board's arrival mute it? Is this what critics have been asking for?
It's not what critics have been asking for, and it's unlikely to mute entirely the criticism of the agency. I mean, the agency has been the whipping boy for, I think it's one of the few things that Republicans and Democrats seem to be agreeing on recently in Capitol Hill, is that the FDA is not doing the job that Capitol Hill wants it to, and things need to change over there.
President Bush just said yesterday that he will nominate the acting commissioner at the FDA, Lester Crawford, to be the permanent head of the agency. And now right out of the box comes this proposal. Of course, it's coming on the eve of big hearings in Washington on Celebrex and another one, you'll know.
Bextra and Vioxx.
That's right, Bextra. Is this a kind of peremptory strike to try and take the heat off the FDA? How do you interpret the timing and shape of this announcement?
I think the timing was determined a little bit by President Bush's announcement about Dr. Crawford. I mean, it's hard to come out with big proposals like this without having a permanent FDA commissioner. Plus, the Health and Human Services Secretary, Mike Leavitt, just got confirmed. Mm-hmm. So with those two appointments in place, I think the agency sort of felt like it could roll out this proposal about drug safety. I think you're right. Also, they wanted to come up with something before this very important advisory hearing that starts tomorrow, at which the agency is expected to get a lot of criticism about how it handled early hints that these drugs, Celebrex, Bextra, and Vioxx, might have hurt the heart. Those drugs have been on the market now for many years, and there are some estimates that Vioxx alone might have led to as many as 55,000 deaths by heart attacks.
And, of course, the critique behind the complaint is along the lines of the FDA being in the pocket of big pharmaceutical companies. This is supposed to be an independent drug safety board. Who will be on it, Gardner Harris?
Well, see, that's one of the issues, obviously, that the Drug Safety Board will be made up, we're being told, of government scientists, people not just from the FDA, but from NIH and other scientific government boards. The board will consult outside experts, but it will be a government board, and it will not be entirely independent of the agency. It will report to not only the FDA commissioner, but actually report even further down than he to the director of the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research, which is a significant part of the FDA.
And what information will they be drawing on that the FDA might have missed to date? What will alert them to problems with drugs that are on the market?
Exactly. I mean, what they're doing is basically taking the information that FDA has at that point and giving advice to the agency about how to handle that information. I mean, what the agency has gotten itself into is that it finds that it constantly has these sort of hot potato studies about drugs that are on the market, and it doesn't really know what to do with those studies. It doesn't know if those studies really define the drug, if those studies illuminate a real risk of the drug, or if they're simply sort of flukes that come along once in a great while. And so up to this point, the agency has taken these studies sort of under advisement and sort of sat on them and stewed on them and tried to come up with a consensus within the agency and then sort of announced that their findings broadly. Their thinking has been that, you know, they don't want to scare people unduly. They want to sort of come up with information that people really can use and not sort of come out and say, well, we don't really know what to do with this. But they're finding that people are deeply dissatisfied with the way the agency has handled this. People do want uncertainty, even when that is the FDA's only answer. And the FDA thinks that this board will be able to make uncertain pronouncements, and that somehow that's going to reassure all of us.
You've got Maurice Hinchey, New York Congressman. You're quoting already Gardner Harris saying the new board is a farce. He says the FDA has faced a real crisis of confidence in recent months. It appears this new oversight board will do nothing substantively to fix that. Still a long road to hoe for the FDA to win public confidence, even confidence among professionals?
I think so. I mean, I don't foresee the criticism of the agency really slackening for some time. There are some real questions going on. I have to say that people within the agency, and there are lots of dedicated public servants, mm-hmm. feel that a lot of this criticism is unfair, and that they're sort of trying as hard as they can, and they can't make sort of gold out of hay when they have studies that show these bad side effects, but the studies themselves have some weaknesses. It's very difficult to figure out what one should do, and so they're sort of being caught in the middle, and they still don't sort of have a way out of their box.
Sounds like they're going to be in the headlights for a while longer. Gardner Harris, thank you for joining us tonight.
Sure, anytime, Tom.
Gardner Harris covers the Food and Drug Administration for the New York Times. He spoke with us from Washington. On the hit TV show Desperate Housewives, Lynette, an overwhelmed mother of four, takes Ritalin so she can stay up late to finish costumes for the school play. In the real world, committed mothers wake up at the crack of dawn so they can spend quality time with their children before they head off to demanding jobs, and then, like Lynette, stay up late into the night making cupcakes for the school bake sale. Every blessing has its burdens, but motherhood today can be a mother load of pressure. And there's a lot of blame to go around. Depending on who you ask, it's the fault of dads, government, the economy, moms themselves, and their conflicted, desperate desires. In a new book, author and mother of two, Judith Warner, explores why this generation of mothers feels so overwhelmed by motherhood. This hour, On Point, Motherhood on the Brink and American Mom's Impossible Pursuit of Perfection. You can join the conversation. Are you a mother on the brink? Has hypercharged mothering turned into a bad deal for everybody, moms, kids, marriage, whatever happened to good enough mothering? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Judith Warner. She's a former special correspondent for Newsweek magazine, co-author with Howard Dean of You Have the Power, How to Take Back Our Country and Restore Democracy in America. She also wrote the best-selling biography, Hillary Clinton, The Inside Story. Her new book is Perfect Madness, Motherhood in the Age of Anxiety. Judith Warner, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So at the heart of this, I see something you might describe as over-parenting. What's the critique that you're making here, Judith?
I'm making the critique that the overly anxious, overbearing, overly perfectionistic and controlling way we go about motherhood right now isn't good for our children, it isn't good for us, and it really does nothing at all to make our society a better place.
What's brought it about? Why are parents, mothers in particular, in the middle of that overparenting, overbearing parenting?
I think it's a combination of factors. I think part of it has to do with who we are in this current generation of mothers, and by we, I'm talking in the book about women who are part of the first post-baby boom generation. Part of it has to do with the way we grew up, the way we came to know and understand ourselves and think about ourselves as women and our place in society, largely in the 1980s, where things were really focused on individualism and on self-perfection. Part of it has to do with the climate in which we mother, where we're bombarded with messages leading us to think that we can control every aspect of our children's lives and be ever more perfect mothers, creating ever more perfect children. And part of it, I think, has to do with objective economic and social pressures around us that leave us feeling very powerless and out of control, and also leave us feeling that we need to take everything onto our own shoulders to make things safe and better for our children.
Make perfection at home, and that may be
outwards.
That may be too much to ask. What are the symptoms? What's the evidence for listeners who may be wondering, is she talking about me? What's the kind of pattern or substance of the overparenting syndrome that you're talking about?
It's what you just described. Working all day, staying up all night, baking for the bake sale, because it would just be too terrible to buy something and bring it, or to make the slice and bake cookies that could be done in 15 minutes. It's the need to always do everything as perfectly as possible, and as a result, to end up feeling like you're a failure.
And you're saying it's not only not good for the kids, it's right in your title, driving mothers crazy. Why? How?
It's that push for perfection. It's a killer. It's a no-win game. There's an email that I saw from a woman today who said that she wakes up every morning dreading the day and cries nearly every day and feels constantly like she just can't do things well enough. And I felt so sad when I read that email, and it also was very familiar to me. I think a lot of women feel that way.
That they just can't do everything, they can't do enough, and yet they're doing so much. Don't they know that it's enough? Why isn't it clear?
Because it never is enough, because the goals are impossible. The amount of stress that women put on themselves, what they demand of themselves and what they feel needs to be done, is just impossible. So they always feel they can't get it done, because in reality they can't.
Judith Warner, stand by. We've got to take a short break here. There's a big thesis we want to unpack. We're talking tonight about motherhood on the brink and American mom's impossible pursuit of perfection. My guest is Judith Warner. Her new book is Perfect Madness. You can join the conversation. Are you a mother on the brink? Has hyper-mothering turned into a bad deal for everybody? Moms, kids, marriages. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about American motherhood on the brink, American mother's impossible pursuit of perfection. My guest is Judith Warner. Her new book is Perfect Madness, Motherhood in the Age of Anxiety. You can join our conversation. When every family is on its own, does every mother feel an impossible responsibility? And where's dad? Where's society in this equation? If everyone agrees it's not working, why can't we get off this treadmill? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Judith Warner, I wonder if you could give us a little bit of motherhood then and now. I don't know if there's a golden age or a better time that you're comparing current circumstances to, but I wish you'd give us a sense of, was there a better time, a time that was less crazy, less mad, to use your word, and what did it look like compared to today's mothering?
I think a lot of women who were mothers in prior generations would probably say that it's always been crazy and hard and stressful and filled with worries. A lot of the women who I spoke with for the book, though, looked back on their own childhoods and remembered their own mothers as though that had been some kind of golden age, when things were calmer and easier, when children were able to just run around after school and not be hyper-managed by their mothers, when fathers came home from work at 5 or 6 in the evening and so families could really sit down together for dinner, and when things were just a little more laid back generally.
And those are the good old days. It sounds like the Leave It to Beaver time. I don't know how long ago that was. Who did you talk to put together your current picture? How did you build this profile of contemporary mothering?
I spoke with about 150 women, about half in the Washington area and the other half from all over the country. And they ranged in age from their late 20s to their mid-40s for the most part.
And you quote one of them saying, "What I'm trying to remember is how I ended up raising this princess, how I got into this mess." Did you hear a lot of mothers saying that they were in some kind of mess?
Yeah, they were in a real quagmire. They couldn't figure out how to make the pieces of their lives stack up in such a way that everything really worked. They would, in many ways, be making choices that seemed to be, let's say, the right choices, and yet things still didn't work. So they would try something else, and it wouldn't quite work. And they couldn't figure out why it was, if they were doing everything right, why things still felt wrong.
Do you have an answer for them, Judith Warner?
I think, again, because what they were trying to do is impossible. Often they were trying to balance unbalanceables. We tend to formulate things in such a simple way. We always talk about the balancing act and priorities and choices that women make. But life doesn't really conform to those words very well. Women aren't balancing children against their ambitions. These are unbalanceable things. What they're trying to do is just make the various pieces hold together in a way that makes sense for everyone and somehow makes life livable and in an ideal situation makes life nice and fun and pleasant and enjoyable for everyone. And it really isn't easy to make those pieces hold together when the way our society is structured is such that it's almost impossible to make work hold together well with family life.
To make family life hold together with work. Are you talking about working mothers or stay-at-home moms or both?
I'm talking about both. I mean, what I was going to say is to make family life something that isn't some kind of ridiculous circuit of competition and stress, it's very, very difficult because of the climate in which we mother.
Competition between families, between kids, between moms to be the most on top of everything?
All of those things. And the worry that mothers battle all the time, are their kids doing well enough? Will their kids be able to compete? Are they going to rise to the top? Are they going to get into a good college? Are they going to be able to make enough money to have a house and to have a family and to pay off their college loans? I think those are the worries that run in the back of parents' minds. And I think they address those worries through almost magical acts, like signing their kids up for the right activities, having them do the right number of sports, put in the right number of community service hours, and it makes them frantic and it makes them crazy.
Now, you describe how women take this onto their own shoulders. They don't think about somebody else or society lightening the burden for them. You write, good daughters of the Reagan Revolution, we disdained social activism, cultivated our own gardens with a kind of muscle-bound, tightly wound, uber-achieving, all-encompassing, never-failing self-control that passed in the 1980s for female empowerment. But you're saying, ultimately, this is not empowering, this drive for perfection.
No, it's not. Privatizing your problems is a kind of giving up, in a sense. It means that you can't look outwards. If you need to take everything onto your own shoulders, if you've got to be the guardian of your children's fates, and, for example, take over their education because the schools are not good enough, so you're going to supplement with tutoring and this class and that class and this art class and this music lesson, et cetera, et cetera. You're doing this because you know there's no hope outside.
I mean, if you don't do it as a mother, no one else will.
That's right. It may feel like you're taking control, but you're micromanaging. You're not changing the objective situation that's causing you all this stress and worry in the first place.
And you're saying that women were initially encouraged to do all this with the cheering on that they could juggle. They could juggle all of this. And you're saying it's not a matter of juggling, or the juggling simply can't be done.
I think under current circumstances, the juggling can't really be done, at least not by most women. If you're lucky enough to have a job that has flexible hours, if you're lucky enough to have a part-time job that pays decently and pays you benefits, then you can juggle, and you can juggle under pretty decent circumstances. But most women really don't have that option. They need to make money. They need to work increasingly long work weeks in order to make enough money to help keep their families going. How do you balance that against the demands of family?
So how do you do it? How do moms, if they're trapped in a kind of rat race of child rearing here, how do they get out of it?
I think women do the best they can, and they try to come up with solutions that work for them, and some of them do manage to. Some of them really do manage to find ways to keep it all together. I think to a large measure that's luck. Often it's women whose husbands earn enough money to give them options in terms of cutting back on their working hours who are able to balance things well. But what I find most inspiring is that there are some women who actually lower the expectations they put on themselves and sort of lower the volume of their mothering so that they do it a little bit more calmly, they do it a little bit less perfectly, they don't have to do absolutely everything all the time, and as a result, they're able to achieve a lot more balance in their lives and a lot more calm in their families.
Where are dads in this picture, Judith Warner?
I was having an interesting conversation about this with someone today. I think that in families where both parents are working And as a result, often I think the child care tasks and housekeeping tasks are split more evenly, so that the fathers are more generally involved with the children. The fathers are drawn into this craziness to a greater extent. I think in the families where the fathers are either the sole breadwinners or are working many more hours and the mothers are more involved with the children, often the fathers have a greater ability to sort of step back and roll their eyes and see all the craziness around them that their wives are very much caught up in.
Mm, and give some perspective. What about the cost of this? Take us down the checklist. What are the costs for mothers, for children, for couples, for romance? How do you tote them up?
You know, you read all kinds of stories all the time about the different pieces of this, about the rate of depression among mothers. You hear women talking about their anxiety. It seems sometimes like there's no one around who isn't taking Ambien at night. You see the statistics on sexless marriages. You hear people talk about the fact that their marriages have, beyond sex, sort of emotionally gone dry, that their real emotional investment is in their children. This has become just a commonplace observation now. It doesn't even strike anyone as strange, I don't think. And now you have more and more experts speaking up to say that all of this is taking a toll on children.
How so? Children
are overstressed, and they're overscheduled, and they're having too much pressure put on them, and they're not developing sufficient empathy because they're becoming so self-centered from all the attention that's lavished upon them. And I think we're going to see more and more writing about that in the years to come.
Children too self-centered because everything's lavished on them. Judith Warner says let's pay more attention to the moms and maybe key down just a little bit. Her new book is Perfect Madness, Motherhood in the Age of Anxiety. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Rita's calling from Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Rita. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, sure.
I had a question and a comment for your guest tonight.
Good.
My comment is based on my own experience. I'm currently 23 years old, and I wanted to share sort of along the minimalist idea of parenting. I think one of the things that might help mothers is a combination of taking one thing at a time rather than over-scheduling, rather than over-expecting, rather than over-planning. So that way there's more patience, I think, to deal with things as they come up without having that pressure that it has to be, as your guest said, the right way to do A, B, C, and D. And the other part is letting the child take the lead and simply realizing that this is a child that's being raised to take his or her place in the world, not the mother's place in the world, not the expectations of the mother, but rather let the child lead in the direction so there's not that pressure to put the kid in the appropriate music class, sign up for the right number of sports, and let your child really be the guide for this rather than making yourself crazy for a life that, you know, is waiting to burst out on its own.
And Rita, what if your child doesn't show the inclination to sign up for all the, you know, check boxes of...
You know, and I think that that's okay. That in part, this is where I think there's a societal issue that we've come to expect that a child who doesn't sign up for the appropriate number of sports or take the after-school music lessons or whatever it might be is going to be intrinsically harmed in the future. And I don't know that that's a correct assumption. I think that we all come to the skills that are right for us or the interests that are right for us that drive us. There's no formula that all children must learn to play the piano by the time they're 13.
And yet it can seem like there's a formula out there these days. Judith Warner, what do you say? Let the child take the lead. Is it good advice? And do you find mothers prepared to do that?
Well, I agree so completely with Rita and what she's saying, and I think she summed it up very, very well. Parents do seem to feel that there is a formula, and it's a kind of magical formula. If the child does this, 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 and this, then everything will be okay. And the odd thing is that rationally we know this isn't true. A lot of us, I think, find ourselves in the situation where we know this isn't the right thing to do, and yet we do it anyway, and we sort of can't help it. And I think that's part of the sort of stuck feeling that a lot of mothers get left with because they're going against their inclinations, their better inclinations. I think that it's very, very hard to stay centered and mother according to your values in the culture that we're in right now because there's always that underlying fear that maybe you're not doing what you might be doing and maybe your child's going to suffer because they didn't get that extra bit of something and is somehow going to pay for it down the line.
And so it's pedal to the metal. Rita, thanks very much for your call. Judith Warner, you are maybe part of a backlash, and I wonder if the backlash is more widespread. I'm looking at some other new titles that are out, and they're funny, and they have a different attitude, not this hyper-obsessed one. There's The Three Martini Playdate. That's Christy Miller's book, Confessions of a Slacker Mom from Muffy Mead Farrell, Cheap Psychological Trick for Parents. And I'm looking here in The Three Martini Playdate. That is a different attitude, not hypercharged. In the chapter headings, saying no to your child, it's a kick. Bedtime is 5:30 too early. Child labor, not just for the third world. And children's music, why? That sounds like a backlash, like a new attitude. Do you see a new generation coming on that's not obsessed with parenting in that way?
I don't think it's a new generation. I think there is a backlash out there. And I think it's the same generation. I think that there are people who are just starting to say, enough, enough. This is ridiculous. I think maybe this started with the book The Blessing of a Skinned Knee. Mm. There have been a number of books for a while written by, let's say, parenting experts or educators. There have been a number of voices rising up to say, this is really ridiculous. And I think what you're seeing right now is some mothers who are starting to write these books. It may be that some of the women writing them, the authors of the books you've mentioned, are slightly younger than I am. Mm-hmm. For example, I'm 39. Mm-hmm. So it may be yet another generational voice of women who are coming to motherhood now and saying, we don't want to do it like you're doing it because it's crazy. One way or the other, I think it's a very good thing.
The Three Martini Playdate, that's got a different theme tenor to it. Nancy's calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Nancy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Judith.
Hi.
Judith, I think this is really a topic that is wonderful for women to hear about. I think I'm a good example of a mom who isn't obsessed with the perfection. And just to give you an illustration, I heard your show on the way home from work after a late meeting, just after I called home and put everybody into action here to get a dinner on the table. I have my wonderful husband who's shoved all the snow off the grill to grill chicken. I have my sons who are busily making smoothies in the blender. And, you know, on some nights, it is just okay with me that everybody just has a bowl of cereal for dinner. You are just not going to be able to pull it off every single night. And on balance, your kids are going to be fine.
Nancy, when you express that attitude to friends, to other mothers, are they with you or against you?
I think that most of my friends are with me.
That is, don't go for hyper-perfection every night, all the time. Forget it.
No, I mean, you know, I think you're falling into the trap that Judith is talking about, that you are going to make yourself just crazy if you do that. And that it's an idealized view. It's not a real-life view. And you have to, you do what works for your kids. And, you know, I think that they're going to come out okay all in the end. And, you know, I wouldn't be able to live my I have a job I love. I wouldn't be able to live my life with this hanging over my head that I've got to be home every night and have a three-course meal on the table.
It would be tough to do.
And, you know, and I also have a great team here who, when I have late nights like this, they swing right into action.
Nancy, we got it. It sounds terrific. We can almost smell the chicken on that snowy grill. Thanks for calling in. Judith Warner, that's an interesting thought. Nancy says, forget it. We're on a different wavelength. But you're writing about many mothers who haven't managed to make it to that wavelength. Who's calling the tune here? Who's sort of setting the pace or the expectations for motherhood now?
I think this started in the 1990s, where it really heated up in the 1990s, with the messages coming out of some parenting guides, out of the magazines that were aimed at new mothers. And I think, you know, you had these messages coming about how you could basically control and mold and perfect your child's brain. You know, a lot of it crystallized around the brain research.
Right. Mozart went still in utero and right on through. It was a work of art in progress.
Well, there even was, I remember, an article in Psychology Today that said, prodigies are made, not born. You know,
that's
kind
of crystallized
the
thinking.
Yeah. You know, you could really control this. And I think to a large extent, this fell on fertile ground with our generation because we were primed to receive messages like this and to run with them. You know, looking back now, when I look back on some of the things that I read when my first daughter was born, I realized that they weren't really so very over the top. But I remembered what I remembered, and I remembered if I read, it's good to talk to your child, well, I talk to her all the time, right. Every waking moment.
Right.
I think a lot of moms did that.
Maybe give that child a little space. Judith Warner, stand by. The new book is Perfect Madness, Motherhood in the Age of Anxiety. You can join the conversation, listeners. How far are you going to do everything for your kids? What about yourself? Has parenting pushed out too many other things? Personal time, romance, life. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about motherhood on the brink and American mom's impossible pursuit of perfection at home with the kids. My guest is Judith Warner. Her new book is Perfect Madness, Motherhood in the Age of Anxiety. You can join us tonight. Are you a mother on the brink, and has hyper-mothering turned into a bad deal for everybody, moms, kids, marriages? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jennifer's calling from Ridgeway, Wisconsin. Hi, Jennifer. You're on the air.
Hi. I just have a quick comment that I want to make that, you know, all of these things that everybody is trying so hard, you know, to make their kids the perfect kid,
yeah.
You know, the soccer, the basketball, the gymnastics, the ballet,
oh, yeah.
That you don't really need those. And by cutting those very things out that are causing you stress and just staying home with your kids, you're going to cut out so much stress, you know. I guess the biggest thing for me is that, you know, at this day and age, yes, it is very hard. My husband and I work very hard to maintain a one-income family. But we do it successfully, and by doing it successfully, our kids are wonderful. And our marriage, you know, everybody has problems in their marriage, but our marriage is very strong and wonderful, too.
And you're saying if you lay out all those goals, it's going to raise the cost of everything and may send you out to work and you lose the thing at home that you're so happy with.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you bring your kids into this world wanting to nurture and help them grow and become amazing adults, and then we send them off. You know, oh, go do gymnastics. Oh, let's go do this. Oh, let's go do that instead of just enjoying your family unit. You
maybe know, just have them jump off the back of the sofa, Jennifer.
Yeah.
We've got it. Thanks for your call. Judith Warner, what about it? Stay-at-home moms versus working moms. Jennifer's at home. She's not hyper about the laundry list of activities that have to be there outside the home, and she's happy with it. But in general, do you see stay-at-home moms as less caught up in over-parenting than working moms or not?
I would say for the most part, it's the opposite. I think Jennifer is really blessed to have the attitude that she does and the ability to sort of, you know, just be home with her kids and not be running them around to a million activities. I think the lives of stay-at-home moms are really, really hard. And I think that often enough when they have very young children, you know, they schedule a lot of activities into the day because it's pretty stultifying. Being at home with their kids. I think that's how they experience it. I think the way we live now, with most people living in suburbs, where they're not going to just go outside and see other people, where there isn't a kind of community life or a tendency of people to gather mm-hmm. in different places where they can be with others, makes, you know, going to music class and art class and this, that, and the next thing kind of feel like survival for a lot of stay-at-home moms.
Because they get a 50-minute break for a cup of coffee while Jenny's at dance.
And they get to see other mothers. Exactly. Mm-hmm. They get to see other mothers. It structures the day. It gets them out of the house. And, you know, I have a lot of compassion for these women. I mean, I obviously do work in that I write, but I write from home. And in the past few years, my life has been very much more like a stay-at-home mother's life than, I guess, like a working mother's life, just in terms of the kind of schedule that I have and the way people on the outside see me. I know what it's like to be viewed as a stay-at-home mom and how hard that can be sometimes, depending on where you live. In a place like Washington that's very competitive, it can be pretty tough.
But I hear you describing stay-at-home moms in some way as the ones keeping the hot tempo going here.
You know, I think, like many things, the task at hand expands to fill the time. I think that working mothers don't have all that much time. So they're more likely to be able to say, look, I just can't do that. I don't have time to do it. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to worry about it. Boom. And, you know, in some ways they can have a little bit more balance and distance towards these things because they don't have time to get caught up in it.
Right.
I think generally, though, in terms of what Jennifer was describing in needing to have kids do all these classes and all these activities because you feel like it's really important for them, I think both working moms and stay-at-home moms do that according to how much they can afford and how much time they can devote to it, whether there's somebody to drive the kids around, et cetera.
Everybody trying to hit that bar. Laura's calling from Amory, Wisconsin, with maybe a comment on point there. Laura, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. And I'm calling because, you know, my children are in school, and they're very, very involved, outgoing children, and they love to be part of many activities and organizations. And sometimes I wrestle with that because I do feel that, I do try to put limits, but on the other hand, they want to be in these things, and plus, all their friends are in them. So there's this view of, well, all my friends are in it, and if I'm not, then there's this feeling of being left out.
So if you were to gear back the whole family, your kids might feel they're not keeping up with the whirlwind.
Right, yeah. And then I feel like, and then the pace of all the other fun things that all of their
right.
friends are doing is they would definitely feel left out. And yet, you know, intuitively, I do feel like we are on this, insane pace.
We hear you, Laura. Let me put that to Judith Warner. There, Laura would like to consider maybe cutting back some, but she's afraid her kids will feel left out.
I can identify that with that completely. I struggle with this all the time. But I think these activities have become like so many consumer products. You know, they see kids doing this, that, and the next thing, and they want to do it. And it's as though they were in the toy store and they wanted this, that, and the other thing. And, you know, it's funny because I don't think we would hesitate necessarily to say no to buying 5 toys at once. But we hesitate to saying no to 5 extracurricular activities in a week because somehow these are things they should be doing. And what'll happen if they feel left out or they're not getting everything their friends are getting?
You're saying no is all right.
I'm saying no is all right, and maybe no is necessary. Maybe it's not healthy to be doing something all the time. Maybe kids have to tolerate a certain amount of boredom and being by themselves and frustration and not always getting exactly what they want. And maybe they have to learn to develop inner resources, which don't get developed if you're always involved in some kind of structured activity.
Long run may be better for them. Dana's calling from Boston. Hi, Dana. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to give a perspective of a daughter. I'm 22, and my mother in the 80s and 90s was a career mom, and she felt incredible pressure to put a beautiful dinner on the table after working a 9-10-hour day.
Mm-hmm.
And she never really met those demands. I mean, we always joked that we had fast food just as much as we had a home-cooked meal, but I am so proud of her and all of her accomplishments, and now I'm pursuing a career and I really just wanted to reassure everyone that, you know, I recognize how great my mom is and never really saw her put together a baked good from scratch. But, I mean, what's important is what's important, and I'm just so proud of everything she's done.
So you're saying, Dana, that perfection wasn't necessary. You got what you needed anyway.
Exactly. And she felt incredible pressure and always felt inadequate. Because she chose to have a career and couldn't really put together, you know, all those traditional things. But I mean, in the end, she's an incredible role model, and I will not be afraid to go pick up dinner from a fast food restaurant I have to.
Dana, let me ask you, because you're at the beginning of that whole journey, will you do motherhood differently? Do you think your mom was in an impossible situation, or are you going to pick up job, you know, career and motherhood and try and do both like she did?
I'm going to try and do both. Right now I'm in law school, so I will pursue a career. I do know that she did have those moments where she felt like she couldn't handle it. My father did work a lot as well and was away on business trips often, so there was a lot of pressure on her, and I saw it, but I know in the end she wouldn't have changed a thing, so I think I'm just going to try and follow in her footsteps.
Right back in the pool. I don't know if that solves the dynamic that Judith Warner is writing about, but we hear you loud and clear, Dana, and thanks for your call. Let me get one more caller here. Rodney is calling from Greensboro, North Carolina. Hi, Rodney. You're on the air.
Hi. I just simply have a question. As a father-to-be, how can someone like myself go about deterring my wife or changing her behavior if she starts to become the kind of mother you're talking about?
Keeping her off the crazy treadmill.
Exactly.
Let's pick it up, Rodney. Thanks for your call. Judith, two things there. One, a kind of intergenerational conversation with Dana and her mom, and her saying she's going to try and do the same thing. And two, Rodney saying, what about dads? What can they do?
I think it's so refreshing hearing what Dana had to say, because that's not what you normally read in the media. You know, you hear the stories about young women turning their backs on careers after having seen their mother slave away. Mm. I've seen these stories a couple of times. I've never heard anyone in real life talk like that. I tend to hear people who talk more like Dana did in it, so it's nice to be able to hear it said on the air where maybe people will hear it.
And she says it wasn't perfect, but it was good, and she respects her mom for it.
And also that what counts, you know, aren't all these things. It's the quality of the relationship, I think, is the subtext to what she's saying.
And Rodney, what's advice for the father?
Well, I'm sure just simply having that attitude is a good thing, and having an eye out for what's absurd is certainly helpful. I think also, too, now, you know, Rodney, the fact that you're even asking this question probably implies that you wouldn't be like this. I think that what's happening in many marriages is that men are really not holding up their end of the bargain, and that women become all the more control freakish because they feel like they've got to do it. It's only them. They're all alone. That's something that I've heard over and over again. Women say, I've come to realize that I'm in it. I'm in this alone.
So it's me or nobody.
And then they become more grasping and controlling.
Mm-hmm. Judith Warner, we've just got a couple of minutes left here. You've got a large political angle to this book, a kind of social agenda that you're saying is not being met or provided now. You're saying women can't do this alone. It requires a concerted political effort to change society in a way that's more supportive. What are you recommending there?
I'm just recommending social supports for families generally. This isn't really something that's just for women or for mothers. I'm recommending changes that will make American middle-class family life easier so that people don't feel so scared and don't feel so pressured and don't feel like they've got to micromanage and control everything because everything is basically out of control.
Changes like what?
Changes like better public education, better and more affordable childcare, measures to give companies incentives to come up with more family-friendly policies so that some kind of balance really is possible. And also measures aimed at stay-at-home moms, too, to give them a break, to bring some kind of good-quality, part-time, affordable childcare to their communities so that their lives don't have to be so hard.
You point to Europe and say it can be done. There's evidence on the other side of the pond. Is it that clear that things can be structured differently so that moms have a better time of it?
To me, it's very clear because I became a mother in France. And for the first 3.5 years that I was a mother, I lived there. I basically learned the beginnings of what I knew about motherhood there and about what family life was supposed to be like, so that when I came here, it was a real culture shock, even though I'm American. I know that things can be different. I know that the French model is not appropriate necessarily for America. We're two very, very different cultures. But there are still lessons that we can learn about specific ways that things can be different, life can be easier, and also that society can help families. These are not necessarily exclusively private concerns that have to be dealt with in private ways.
I'm reading Anna Quinlan, who's writing on the subject on the theme this week in Newsweek. I guess you're in Newsweek as well this week, Judith Warner. And she quotes her eldest child, who she had some difficulties with, finally saying, what I remember most, that is, about his childhood, is having a good time. Anna Quinlan says, you can engrave that on my headstone right this minute. That will do. Forget the schedule. Having a good time is maybe as important as anything else. Judith Warner, we're very grateful to you for your time tonight and for all your thoughts. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me on the show.
Judith Warner, she is author of the new book, Perfect Madness, Motherhood in the Age of Anxiety. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, the long life of a very tall tree. This is On Point. The Washington Tree in California's Sequoia National Park once stood at more than 254 feet tall, about the height of a 25-story building. It was believed to be the second tallest tree in the world, but centuries of snow and windstorms have taken their toll, along with a forest fire that 2 years ago reduced the Great Sequoia to less than half its original height. After this winter's storms, park rangers speculate that the ancient tree, estimated to be as much as 3,200 years old, may be in the final decades of its life. In this radio diary, Bill Tweed, chief naturalist at Sequoia National Park in Central California's southern Sierra Nevada, shares how the world's largest trees survive the winter and how the Washington tree is faring.
For many years, the national snowfall record for the United States for 24 hours was held in the giant forest. It was 50 inches of snow in 24 hours, which fell back in the 1930s on these big, beautiful trees. And it's usually heavy, wet snow. So snow and winter storms play an important role in challenging the older sequoias as they begin to weaken in their old age. We can have tons and tons of weight on these trees, and occasionally wind in addition to the weight. All this can stress the trees and weak spots fall off. We've had a heavy winter in California. We've had lots of snow in the Sierra this year. And we've had a number of sequoias of varying degrees of size and fame fall within the giant forest. But the one that's attracted the most attention, because it's the best known, has been the Washington tree. When you looked at the tree, you saw this tall cylinder, 270 feet tall, towering in the sky with branches off it. But until the tree was climbed for the first time a few years ago, nobody knew that fires long ago had hollowed out the tree. And then a year ago, another fire got into the top of the tree as a part of a natural burn that was burning in giant forest, a lightning-started fire, and it rekindled the top of the tree and burned more of the center of the tree out. And now that thin rim of wood that constituted much of the top of the tree is falling off a piece at a time. We often talk here in the park about sequoia time, that when you're living around organisms that are so long lived, you have to adjust your human sense of time. That this idea that everything happens in years or decades simply doesn't apply always to giant sequoia trees. If we accept the premise that even in a human body, cause and effect can be half a lifetime apart, then cause and effect in a sequoia might be 1,000 years from one step to the next. We really don't know if that's true or not, but it makes us a little humble about jumping to conclusions about what's going to happen next with a giant sequoia tree. These are trees whose perception of time is way, way beyond anything that comes with human generations.
Bill Tweed is chief naturalist at Sequoia National Park. He spoke with us from Three Rivers, California. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.